All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck nicks, what the fuckers, what the fucking ucks? What the fucking ucks? Let's start there. Thank you, Canada. Thank you, Montreal Just for Laughs Festival. Thank you. I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. You know the show. Okay? I was just in Canada last weekend for the Just for Laughs. I've been up there many times. I was trying to think how many times I've been up to that Just for Laughs Festival. A lot of times. 93, 94, I went up there as a correspondent for Comedy Central for my show Short Attention Span Theater, and I couldn't have been more embarrassed to be up there as the guy holding the mic, interviewing other comics. It was humiliating to me. I do remember that much. I do remember wearing clothing that wasn't mine because I was on a TV show, walking around, sticking my mic into the faces of established comics because I was that guy. I was the guy with the mic who did the thing. There's nothing more embarrassing or more humiliating when you're a comedian and that's the gig you got. Hey, I'm the guy with the mic talking to people who are doing real things. What do you do? I'm the guy with the mic. I'm holding the mic with the thing on it that says Comedy Central. Are you a comic? That question doesn't even come up. You're just that guy, the guy with the mic. So it's a long way from there now, I'll tell you that. I've been up there several times. I did several galas over the last few years. I never think it's enough about me, but that's normal. Every comic in the world is up there. Saw a lot of old friends. But I do want to thank all the people for coming out to the solo show. We did good, man. A lot of WTF people, a lot of What the Fuckin' Ucks came out. It was a very interesting show. I had this kid, Adam Newman, open for me. He did a few minutes, forgot one of his jokes, went into a tailspin, but pulled it out. Then I got up there and people were chatty, not heckle chatty, but sort of like, I guess he's talking to me. It doesn't matter. There's 400 and some odd people in the room chatty. It's just me and him and me and Mark. And I'm going to ask him about his relationships. I'm going to ask him about how's it going. We're going to chime in. Some guy with a weird laugh. It was a very bizarre time, but I invite bizarre. I do not mind bizarre times on stage because then it's interesting for everybody. Today on the show, Adam Ferrara. You may know him from Rescue Me. You may know him from Nurse Jackie. And he's also on the American version of Top Gear. But I've known him for years as a stand-up comic, and he's a pretty good guy. Good guy, funny guy, very efficient comedian. I've really known him a long time. I used to have a problem with him because I thought he was too fucking cute. But you know, we all get old. We all get locked in. We all get deep in the groove. This is the life. We're trying to hang on. Hope you're doing all right. Glad you got a gig scene. You know what I'm talking about? So I'll be talking to Adam Ferrara in just a minute. But let's talk about Montreal Comedy Festival a bit. It was great to see some of my old friends. But the first morning we were there, we did the new show, Opie and Jim. That's Opie sans Anthony. Just Opie and Jim live in Montreal. I get down there at 9 o'clock, and who's on the couch? Judy Gold, Bill Burr, Bob Kelly, Dave Attell, Nick DiPaolo, and Ari Shaffir. We're all sitting there. That's like a ton of comics. And for some reason, we were all just idiots. Couldn't get our words out. Couldn't get a laugh. Couldn't get any traction going. It was pretty stunning. Oh, and Jim Jeffries, who was like horrendously hungover, which I think is an ongoing state for him. But we just couldn't get it going. It was kind of hilarious. It was great to see Nick DiPaolo, too. I love seeing that guy. It's like going to Montreal is like it's like a high school reunion. But because of the industry, you get the feeling like, how come there are more teachers here than students? And why do we still act like we're in school when we're around them, even though we're 25 years into this? A lot of industry. Everyone's getting real shit-faced. So if you're diligent and you hang in, you can usually get some honesty out of people that are not capable of that generally. But we're all sitting there, couldn't get a laugh there on Opie and Jim's show. And it was very funny that we just couldn't get any traction going because there was a live audience there. And then Pete Holmes shows up. And I got to say, I initiated a bit of a pile on. So someone had to be thrown to the wolves in order to get some laughs. And that was Pete. And Pete, you know, whether he knows it or not, is just a mark for that, man. He's just volunteering that. He's like, welcome all. Come inside me. Pete will take any kind of attention. So that it worked out well. It didn't, you know, it wasn't that much bullying. Just a bit. And I got to admit, it's a little fun to bully Pete. After the radio show, Attell, who I've known, you know, half my fucking life, was like, you want to get something to eat? I'm like, yeah, let's go. He says, you want to get some, what do you want to get, coffee? You want to get some breakfast? You want to go to the deli? And we're like, well, maybe we'll go to the smoked meat place. Let's go to Schwartz's. It's 10:30 in the morning. I don't even know if they're open. But we walked for like 45 minutes. And, you know, Attell is, I consider a very close friend. And he's obviously one of the best comedians in the world. And I've known him since it feels like we were kids. But I don't ever really get to talk to him. Like, if I see him in New York, it's always like, what? Yes. All right. Why? And, you know, it's 5 minutes in interaction. You know, anytime I see him in New York, it's a 5 minutes in passing, very intense, and then he moves on. So now here we are locked in for about an hour and a half. We got to walk 45 minutes one way. We're going to have something to eat and walk 45 minutes back. It's a lot of Attell time. And I loved it. No one makes me laugh more than Dave Attell. And we get to we walk to Schwartz's. Now, Schwartz's is not fundamentally a deli. They have smoked meat. They're known for smoked meat, which I believe is the same piece of meat as the it's a brisket. So that's what they make corned beef out of. That's what they make pastrami out of. But it's not either. It's somewhere in the middle. It's thick cut. It's slightly spiced. It's prepared a different way. I think it's cured and then it sits for a week or something and then they cook it. But it's unique. It's unique Jew food from Canada, from Montreal. And Dave and I are Jews. We're slowly becoming old Jews. I think Dave might have been ahead of me on that. Maybe not. But Dave's used to regular American delis. And I know in my mind that this is not really a deli. They got smoked meat and coleslaw and pickles and that's it. And you don't really order anything else. So we go in there and he's trying to be healthy. This is a historical event that I'm describing you. By the way, I'm not setting you up for a disappointment here. This is Canadian history that I'm about to tell you. Canadian history. Do you hear me? Are you listening to me? There should be a plaque. So Dave and I are both trying to be healthy, but I've given in. You know, I'm like, I'm here, I'm going to eat. And like, I regret that now because I'm sitting out here in my underwear with a little more of me than I anticipated. I was trying to get healthy. That lasted a couple of weeks. I'm just tired of me. It doesn't matter. Let's get back. So me and Attell, we have a nice conversation. We catch up. We talk about our families, our lives, the business, girlfriends, this, sex, whatever. We do the thing. We have the conversation that men have. How you been doing? Let's get it covered. All right. We good? Good. So then we're sitting at the deli and Dave's like, yeah, can I get some soup? Do you have any soup? No. He's like, can I do a half and half, like a half turkey and a half the smoked meat? Because they don't have eggs. Dave wanted eggs. No eggs. Just it's smoked meat. That's it. Basically, that's what you get there. The other stuff is just there just in case somebody doesn't understand what's happening. And this guy who said he'd been working there 33 years says, you don't want to get the turkey. And Dave's like, but I don't want to eat all that. It's like 11 in the morning. I mean, what am I going to do? I don't want to do that to myself. Can I get a half and half? And he's like, you just get the smoked meat. That's what we do here. We do smoked meat. And he explained how the meat was made, which I paraphrased earlier. And Dave's like, I don't know. And I'm like, look, why don't you get a turkey? I'll get a smoked meat and we'll split them up. And I didn't even want the turkey. I was in. I'm ready to eat the whole fucking smoked meat sandwich. So we have this conversation. We don't know what's going to happen. We get some pickles. We get some coleslaw. And then the guy brings Dave a sandwich. He brings me a smoked meat sandwich. I'm rye bread. He brings Dave a half smoked meat, half turkey. But he told us that the turkey was just processed turkey. Nothing special about it. They don't make it there or nothing. That's why he was steering Dave away from it. But he made the sandwich anyways. He made half a smoked meat sandwich and half a turkey sandwich. And he looked at Dave and he said, this is the first time that this has ever happened in the history of Schwartz's, and that's an 84-year history. That sandwich has never been served. It's never been done. There's never been a half and half. There's never been a half turkey, half smoked meat sandwich. And I saw it. It was made for Dave Attell. This is Canadian history. This is a moment in Canadian history that I witnessed. And then Dave Attell experienced. We were both there. We something should have been recorded, but in the first time in Schwartz's 80-some-odd-year history, because of Dave Attell, a half-and-half sandwich was served. And I don't think that's not nothing. All right? We did it. Me and Dave, primarily on his will, changed the game. We changed it. I'm not saying it's a precedent. I'm not saying you should go into Schwartz's, or I don't know why you would. But I'm saying that a precedent has been set. History has been made. A half turkey, half smoked meat sandwich has been served at Schwartz's in Montreal. All right? So I was there for 3 days. It felt like a month. I was exhausted. And what did I learn? I learned that the audiences for me, who came out specifically to see me, were better than the general audiences that I performed for up there. But you know what? Quite honestly, I got to quit being judgmental. Canadians are a polite bunch. They're a good audience. They're attentive. They're even more polite than Americans when they're drunk, which is an amazing indication. See what the sort of peace of mind that comes from knowing that when shit gets bad, you can just go into a doctor. You see what that does to people? It makes them polite. Makes them less frightened. Think about it. Thank God I have insurance. All right, we're going to talk to Adam Ferrara now. Is that okay? It's great. Had a nice conversation about dads and dudes. He's a different kind of dude than I am. It's a car guy. Guy's guy. So let's do it. Well, I mean, but you're a guitar guy, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got right into what guitar guys do. Amateur guitar guys.
Yeah.
Oh, is that guitar?
You pick it up.
Yeah. Let me show you what I can do.
And then we said, I know the beginning of this song.
Yeah, yeah. I know this one lick.
I can get to this part until Clapton goes off.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, but that's the weird thing about my guitar, because I never learned all the songs all the way through. I just like to play my own leads.
Yeah.
But I never like disciplined myself to sort of like work out the riffs of any song that wasn't like dan, 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 or simple.
Well,
or
it was different now, because when we did it, you had to slow the record down and listen to it.
Yeah,
and,
but were you meticulous like that? Could you
the ADD then, I had it then.
You do?
Oh, it's bad.
But you're, how old are you? You're 4 years difference than me? You're my brother's age. You're 48?
48, yeah.
I'm 50. So it's same time.
Yeah.
So
we grew up. The same thing. We didn't have the patience, but I don't think we'd ever have the patience, but we didn't have the technology. Now you can go on YouTube.
I know, but there were guys back when we were kids that could figure that shit out.
Hated those bastards.
Me too. Did you play in bands?
I did. I wasn't really that. It was garage three chord stuff.
Oh, you didn't play out?
Yeah, we played out in college.
How many songs did you have when you played out?
Eight. And you play two of them again at the end.
Yeah.
And one of them's always Born to be Wild.
For the new people.
Yeah, but those
new people just joining the party.
Just showed up. Here's some more George Thorogood because we can play it.
Yeah. You play slide?
No, we always mess that.
I figured
out, because I was trying to play slide, and I figured out I had to raise my bridge because I kept hitting the frets.
But it's funny to me that you grew up, like, when you say Anthony Cumia from Opie and Anthony, that you grew up with him. Sometimes I think that his anger is beyond anything I can understand. And I would try to, he must have been sort of just a pretty sweet kid at some point, huh?
We all were. I mean,
what happened to us?
I mean, we were nice.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have anything.
Yeah.
We had the little apartment that he had holes in the sheetrock. The landlord would
when
come
when you guys
by.
Were, like, moved to New York, or what
well,
are you talking
no,
about?
No, when he was there in Long Island, when we grew up, when he was still knocking tin, and I was working at a fence.
What's knocking tin mean?
Ductwork.
Oh, really?
Tin knocker,
that's what he did?
Yeah. Him and his brother, Joe.
Yeah.
And I worked at a fence company.
You did?
Yeah.
What, in high school?
High school, yeah. We kind of met like junior high. We say grew up together, but it was that era, like he's a little bit older than me.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like junior high school. We met each other and started hanging out. But we had no money, no nothing. The landlord would come. He had an apartment.
Yeah.
And we would hide in the wall.
But you were already not living at home?
No, I was living at home, but I would go over to the apartment. Yeah. That was the honeycomb hideout.
It
was
okay,
the shack.
Right.
And a sense of humor was a coveted thing because we didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
And he's...
sit around bust balls?
Just bust balls and laugh and watch TV. And we used to rent Bugs Bunny cartoons and freeze the frames and stuff and just start riffing on the pictures.
Yeah.
Just that our formative years.
Well, where did you grow up? What part of
Long Island?
But what part?
Huntington, Long Island.
And that was Italian?
Yeah, Italian-Jewish. So it was very much... my family would fix their houses, and their family would represent us when things went wrong, you know. But it was right on that border.
And a big Italian family?
Yeah. Well, depending on who makes parole, yes. But it's a lot of people.
Really?
My house was, you know what the cool thing about my house? It was the place in the neighborhood people would hang out.
Yeah.
And my brother's
and family too?
Yeah, my father's family would come over, my mother's family, so there's a lot of people. That has since gone now.
I miss that part
gatherings of
the East Coast. I'm from Jersey originally, my family is, but like, you know, my grandmother's house was sort of a hub for people coming around.
Yeah.
And that would be a whole day.
Yeah.
Just like people would come around, eat things.
Lunch at 2 o'clock,
people laying
around.
Some people would watch TV, some people would be outside with the kids,
football,
whatever.
Football playing, games on, people sleeping on the couch.
Do people still do that shit?
It's something I do remember finally from my childhood. I don't experience now as an adult that much anymore.
But it's weird because we kind of got off that track somehow.
I think because we moved away.
Yeah, you know, your brother's still around
there? My brother still keeps it going. Like, when I get home, I kind of collect everybody up and say, come on, we're going to meet at this restaurant. Because my mom's not cooking anymore. You know, right. We meet at this restaurant. I bring everybody together and we laugh and
yeah.
They have their kids. So I try to do that when I go home.
How many brothers and sisters?
Two. I got two brothers.
Oh, that's it. Three is.
Yeah, it's three of us. But that whole thing at the house, like after my house Thanksgiving, it looked like Jonestown. His body's laying all over the freaking place.
But what did your dad do?
He did kitchens and bathrooms. He would design and build kitchens and bathrooms. He was very mechanical.
Yeah. But in the city and stuff or just around town?
No, he would do it. He was with, it was a plumbing company. My grandfather,
Plumbers.
Joseph O. Ferrara and Sons.
Yeah.
Yeah. In Queens, where I was born in Queens. And him and my uncle Lou went into that business. And my father moved out to Long Island and made it more of like custom kitchens, custom bedrooms.
So he would do the custom work, and then he'd bring his brother in.
Oh, they split at that point.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
But who would do the plumbing? He would do all of it.
Then he would hire guys to do it. He was more of a designer, more of an artist that way. He had that mechanical ability.
But he was a good plumber?
Yeah. Well, let's be honest. I know it. How hard could it be? Shit don't go uphill.
No,
man, you've solved the mystery, Mark.
No, but sometimes pipes are tricky.
Pipes are tricky. Yeah. You know, they bend sometimes.
Yeah, but you're like getting them sealed properly and getting them to fit.
The and torch
like,
and everything.
Well,
and
yeah, because like sometimes, like it, that's the weird thing about the guts of a house. It's like, you know, it should be simple.
Yeah.
But as soon as you sit down and try to do it, you know, it's sort of like, but why is it still leaking a little bit?
Because
you don't have that thing.
Yeah.
That one thing that makes you know how to stop that, whatever the fuck that is.
I learned how to clean the pipe, and then you got to sweat
wrap,
the joint.
But you got to wrap that.
The sod of flux with the torch and everything. Yeah, I was terrible at it. That's when I realized, and my father
But there's some sort
too.
Of tape you put in a joint. Like
Teflon.
Teflon tape on a that's my, that, thread. I didn't torch anything. But I had a guy come in and fucking remount my toilet, and I thought, you know, and just because I was there watching him, that I felt like I'd done it myself, and I was... And I was proud.
I'm like, oh, let's get back to the truck.
But I love that guy. Yeah. I mean, I call him for anything now. Yeah. Like, even though, like, out here, that job, like, I once talked about it on stage in North Carolina about what I had done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, apparently the mount, like, I didn't realize that the toilet just sits over a hole.
Yeah.
And that there's a mount and then
and
there's a wax seal.
Yeah, the seal on
the something had gone, you know, the seal had eroded and, you know, whatever, and everything was corroded. So you had to take the toilet off and then
reseat it?
Yeah, put a new mount in, a new seal in and all that shit. And it cost me like $900.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that's not, that's LA prices.
You got a shit.
Yeah.
You know?
You don't want it coming down the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They said, look, I got him by the ass.
Yeah. But is this your father's jokes?
No, this is just. I didn't have that. See, that's the thing. But that craftsmanship and that attention to detail and watching my father do that stuff.
But the ability to repair, too.
Repair and to design and to make it work and make it fit.
Yeah.
And I was always enamored with that ability, and I didn't have it. And I really felt less than because I don't. You know?
But was there a time where he was, like, taking you through the sort of the whatever the saying is, did he want you to do that?
He wanted us to be happy, but he was the thing that my father... wanted us to be better than him. He'd always said, he goes, hey, I'm not your friend.
Yeah.
I'm your father.
Right.
He goes, my job is to give you a better life than I had, and I'm not breaking my ass if you're not going to pay attention.
What does that mean? You're out if you don't appreciate me?
He goes, let's pick this. There was no question in my house who was, I remember once I said, Pop, we don't think this is fair.
Yeah.
Fair? Let me explain something to you. You live in a dictatorship. I'm the dictator. The minute you feel you have a vote as to what goes on in this house, just sit down till that feeling goes away.
Did he say that?
Exactly. And I went, you know, I went to my brothers. I go, all right, you know the coup d'etat? It's over.
Yeah.
We're not,
we can't take over.
Yeah, we're done.
There's no possibility as long as that guy's in the house.
You know what he used to do? He would let us do what we had to do, but it was very, I would go out like on a school night. I had to be home at like 9 o'clock, whatever it was.
Right.
And he went to work in the dark and came home in the dark. He was always working.
So wait, in the morning, early?
Yeah. So I remember him saying, are you going to go out and do what you got to do? Fine. I'm setting my alarm for 9 p.m. You better turn it off before I do. And I had to come home and make sure the alarm, not waking him up, make sure the alarm was off and reset for him to get up in the morning, because
that was his game. That was the his trick. Game.
One night I didn't.
What was your mother doing?
What? My mother was like, well, she's not going to get in the way.
Whatever he says.
Whatever your father says, I don't want. Can someone help me clean this?
Yeah.
There was always no one helped clean.
Yeah, yeah.
So one night I didn't get home in time. I actually blacked out the house. I threw the fuse. Because I had to stop the clock from going off.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Was he a good guy or an angry guy?
No, he was a good guy that was just overwhelmed. You know, he was a really good guy, my dad.
Three brothers, and how'd they turn out?
Great. Yeah. They, you know, we're
all overwhelmed with everything?
Overwhelmed with the survival, the financial survival, and just the... He had a temper. There was no question that he was in charge, and he had a temper, and he would yell a lot.
Yeah,
he had a look too.
Yeah,
I have a line in my act that my father would give you the look. Not only did you know you were in trouble, but all the plants would die.
Yeah, all around you.
Yeah, it's like he gave me that look at the beach once, and the tide went out. I mean, it was just he was a formidable, powerful man.
Yeah,
and when he yelled, the earth shook, and then you could see him feel bad about it. Because he was a powerful guy. And he had great empathy, my father. He was a great humanitarian. He believed people. He goes, hey, people fuck up. Mm-hmm. He goes, you're going to fuck up. I'm going to fuck up. He goes, you're going to fuck up worse than me.
Right.
Only because you're younger than me.
I've already
known that I'm not going to fuck up that way again.
Right. That's a good lesson.
So
I understand, but I'm not going to do it, but I know where you're at.
But I'm going to fuck up with different shit.
Yeah.
So get past you fucking up and forgive others for fucking up.
That's a true thing, man. Is that because that's sort of like the idea of the notion of sin, you know, like in Catholicism or anything else. The idea of sin is not, it's not there to make us be perfect people. It's there for us to calibrate our morality. Do you know what I mean? The sins aren't something that we can eradicate.
Mm-hmm.
You just know that they're bad.
Yeah.
And then when it happens, it's like, oh, that can get pretty bad.
And if you keep doing it, learning from the sin. My father always said,
that's why they invented hell, is because of that. This guy keeps doing it.
Listen.
He doesn't.
He keeps doing it.
Yeah, he's nice.
What are we going to do?
We give him a lot of shots.
Yeah.
I guess he wants to live down there.
How long can I do this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When is enough?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When is this guy going to just give it a rest?
Yeah.
He's going to hurt himself and end up in hell. But which were you is, brought up with that?
Catholicism? Catholic? Yeah, I was brought up with the idea of do unto others. Again, my father, he didn't like herd mentalities, my dad, and he looked at religion and everything. He goes,
oh, good.
But he was very funny because he pretty much said, look, you've been baptized.
Yeah.
You've made your confirmation. You made your first communion.
Yeah.
We're Catholics. Yeah. All your paperwork is done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. You want to go to church? Fine. You can go. Sundays, I won't be there. Because if God's everywhere Sunday, God and I are going to watch football. Go in peace.
Yeah.
That was it.
But he knew that he had done his responsibility.
He did his due diligence.
Yeah. The ones that you can't, that you have to do.
Yeah. Look, they say this is what you got to do.
You got to do it.
To get into a sacred gated community.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. But the Sunday thing's negotiable.
Yeah.
If you did the other stuff.
I got shit to do.
Yeah. You got baptized. You did the thing. So you're in.
Yeah.
I
made my confirmation. It was during the week. You make your first.
I don't even know what that shit is.
Communion. It's your.
Oh, the first communion is when you eat the cracker.
Body of Christ. There you go.
Right, but
your confirmation is.
But first communion,
like your bar mitzvah.
Right, but first communion.
I got a bike. You got a trust fund.
Oh, I wish I got a trust fund. Got a few bucks. I might have a few Israel bonds I haven't cashed for $25 that matured in 1977.
That's my tree.
Yeah, yeah. I got a few trees, but those get planted. Before, but. But the communion thing is something, the first communion is the first time you take the sacrament, right?
Yeah.
And what age is that?
You go to, I'm going to say sixth grade and I'm probably wrong.
So you don't eat the body of Christ before that?
You're not supposed to.
Okay. You know, okay. So that's a thing.
I think that
baptism is a thing. First communion is a thing.
Confirmation. That's your paperwork.
That's the three things. And you did all that.
Yeah. We need proof of insurance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
License, registration, right. Whatever.
And that you know who Jesus is.
Yeah.
You got the idea.
Yeah.
You know that you're not supposed to fuck up
He's dead, your fault.
Yeah. He's dead. And for you, he died. For you, as an example.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that didn't stick.
Well, it didn't. It was, my father didn't like the whole kind of.
What about your mother? Your mother must have some.
My mother had the saints, and now she's still got the saints and the figurines. And she's a convenient Catholic, my mom.
Yeah,
we wanted to sell a house. There's a thing called St. Joseph. You bury St. Joseph in your yard, and it's supposed to bring buyers to the house.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know you had to bury him upside down.
So you buried him right side up?
I didn't bury. I came
What, do you
home.
Buy the statue, you mean?
Yeah, they sell them.
Yeah, no, I know.
Oh, sure.
So she buried the St. Joseph?
My father was digging a hole. I go, what are you doing? He's like, your mother, I got to bury this little man in this little hole. Because your mother wants to sell the house. Nice Catholic family. Son, I'll sell it to Jews, Muslims, Martians. If you're pre-approved, this is the house for you.
He didn't care.
He didn't care. So he goes to bed. My mother goes, she does something. One of her girlfriends, you know, yeah. those pain in the ass older lady. Like, I just don't understand. Carl can't get a job. Carl's drinking rum at 7:30 in the morning. It's not the economy.
Yeah.
Says, well, did you bury him upside down?
Yeah.
And my mother panics.
Yeah.
She's like she can't even watch Wheel of Fortune anymore because she just, it's a W! Screaming.
Yeah.
So she comes rushing home, wakes up my father. Did you bury him upside down? And they're out in the middle of the night trying to find it because she's afraid that, you know, if he's facing one. East, terrorists will show up. He doesn't fucking know.
But that was one of those moments your father could have said, yeah, I did.
Yeah. I guess he didn't think of it. But he's out there digging a hole and spinning the thing.
She must have known that he was lying.
Yeah.
Because he would think, like, you know, of course, yeah, I buried it upside down.
Of course.
Yeah. She's like, did you?
What, no. Am I a heathen?
Okay, I knew.
Of course I did.
And who bought the house? Good Catholics?
I don't know. A lawyer. I think a Jewish guy bought it. A lawyer bought the house.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So when did you start doing comedy? Because I remember you from when we were kids, kind of. Yeah. I think, but I don't remember where how did you start? Where you started?
I started on Long Island. I started
at
Eastside Comedy Club.
Not Pips?
No, that was Brooklyn. I started Eastside Comedy Club, Richie Minervini. Pips was Sheepshead Bay.
Oh, that's right. That's right, Brooklyn. Yeah.
And I met you in the city, but you were a city comic. You were like one of those intelligent city comics, and I was always a little intimidated.
I can't remember when the fuck we first met, though.
I think we were at the Cellar. I don't remember when we first met, but I remember one night we both had spots at the Cellar. Like, we were right after each other on three shows on a Saturday.
Yeah.
And we went to the Shakespeare Book Company, and I bought Jerusalem Syndrome and made you sign it.
Oh.
Yeah, it was because I was like, wow, he wrote a book.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, he's smart.
I don't, like, because I feel like, you know, it wasn't a matter of smart, but you always were like, You're a very good performer, and you know, and you were very charming, and you did a lot of long form stuff and a lot of relationship stuff, and you were always so chipper up there. It used to drive me nuts. He's like, this guy's a real showman.
That fucking smile.
Yeah.
Face.
Look at him. He's just milking it.
Oh, look at him.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's not joy. He's making it up.
Yeah, I feel like there was another time. I feel like when I lived in. When did you start headlining? Really? Like early though, right?
Yeah, it was early, but it was. I'm gonna say 90. I started July 13th, 1988. It was a Wednesday night open mic.
Is that true? That's when you started. That's
first
when
time
you
on
first
stage.
Started. That's
first
when
open mics.
In August of '88, I had been doing it maybe 2 years, and that's when I started working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't start working. I started on Long Island, and I started haunting open mics. And I got lucky.
Long Island?
Yeah.
How many could there have been?
There was a lot at that point, because '88, that's when everyone...
The boom, huh?
Well, they figured out it was cheap to produce.
Where the fuck was that other one, Governor's?
Governor's still there.
They have a great sound system they used to have. Do they still have that good sound system?
Yeah.
They still let people smoke in the room?
No. Remember that?
Oh, Jesus, dude. In my memory, they were letting people do it after it was, like a law. But I remember it was like, it was definitely one of those rooms. Maybe not.
Yeah.
But it was definitely one of those rooms where people fucking smoked.
Oh, yeah. Smoked. Yeah. We're not fucking around.
Yeah.
And I would smoke on stage because I wanted to be like Bill Hicks.
Yeah, I smoked on stage all the time.
Yeah.
I set my hair on fire once.
You're kidding.
Flipping my hair up. Yeah, I set my hair on fire.
Like Gene Simmons spitting the fire?
Well, no, it was like I used to smoke, but like my hair was long, so it gets sweaty, and sometimes it falls. So I used to do this thing where I whip my hair back, and somehow or another, I managed to ignite it. But I smoked on stage all the time. You don't smoke anymore, do you?
No, I quit.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How much did you smoke?
I was a pack a day for a while. I quit for a long time, and then I quit for about 3 years, and then I got a job. I met Leary. Right back to smoking again. We were all
he goes
smoking.
On and off.
Yeah, but this was the first show.
What, the job?
The job, yeah. And we were all just smoking. Lenny was smoking big cigars, and we were all smoking.
Big Lenny was smoking big cigars.
Big cigars.
Yeah. All right, but before all that, so you start in 1988, and then what, you do the workout on the island.
Yeah.
When did you start coming in?
I didn't start the city because I knew the city was like, you know, I didn't want to go until I felt I was ready.
But you weren't headlining by 89.
No. I was headlining by... I'm going to say 3 years in, so let's say 90, 91. But it was
I'm trying
to... Remember Scarpatti Rooms? Andy Scarpati had those rooms in Philly, those little like, just they were just weekend
rooms.
You
and I ran in different circles because, you know, you can speak the language of someone from Philadelphia. Like, I think that was another point of contention with me is that, you know, I was always like, I'm a bizarre, you know, strange man. I can only speak, I can't speak the language of men.
Yeah. Well, it's the vocabulary.
Yeah, right.
He uses too many syllables.
It was not even, I don't think it was that complicated, but I had a sensitivity and a weird discomfort that was like, why doesn't this guy just get it together? When's he going to realize that the women, you can't do anything with them? Usually they're a problem.
He's complaining about everything. Yeah. Does he come to the conclusion it's probably him?
No.
But that's one of the things I admired about you is the introspection and talking about the feelings and stuff. Right. Italians, we didn't, you know.
You had a couple, you had like anger.
Yeah, and you're either asleep or pissed off. That was the whole thing. I remember once telling my father, I said, Pop, I'm not happy. Welcome to Earth.
No, he did not.
Yes.
Come on.
There was no.
That's hilarious.
There was no,
he really
like,
said that?
Yes. He would say, he goes, you know what it is? You got too much time on your hands to worry about what you don't have. You really want to be happy? Put a bank on your back for 30 years. Go buy a house and a mortgage. And every month when you pay it off, fuck you. Gotcha again.
Yeah.
See you next month.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That's fucking, I like that advice. That's the amazing thing that I was denied by not having like a working class.
My
grandfather was, but I don't remember. I was never old enough to talk to him about that kind of stuff. Yeah. But there's something about people who accept their lot in life that know what they're here to do. They're okay with dying to some degree as long as they're living the life that they want to live. And that's that.
Yeah. Make it. Well, it's also it what he was doing. And now when I look back, he was defining himself. He goes, look, I got my wife. I love her. I'm going to take care of my family. This is what I got to do.
If
I got time for other shit, fine.
But
if I got time on my hands, I'm not going to wonder why I'm here. I know I'm here to make these people's lives better, and hopefully we can go camping.
Yeah.
That was it.
You did. You went camping?
Yeah, we went camping. You ever see Italians camp?
No.
My mother's hanging fucking cheese
Stop
in a tree.
It.
I
Stop
swear
it.
To God.
Come on.
Swear to God.
Salamis?
Yeah, we had that. We had a boat. We had a
that makes sense.
The 1971 Sea Ray Cuddy cabin.
So your dad liked the boat.
Yeah, we would go up to Lake George with freshwater and camp
upstate
on
New
an
York?
Island. Yeah,
really.
And he made this little.
So you put
thing
the boat on the trailer.
On a trailer, drove up in the van. First, we would pull it in a caddy in a 70 coupe, like gangsters breaking a break for it.
Yeah, yeah.
This big long Cadillac pulling a boat.
Yeah.
And my father made this little sink with a pump and two cabinets.
He built it.
Built it, put it in the back of the boat. It would come up out, and my mother would put it in the tent, and we had a kitchen. We had running water on a fucking island.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, he made a pump and a waste
station. So what did you have, a tent?
Yeah, we had a tent. I used to sleep in the boat because when it rained, you couldn't get near the side of the tent because the water would come in. And then I figured, these guys are idiots. This boat's a cabin. It's a hard rule. I'll sleep in the boat.
So this is a regular family thing?
Yeah, every year, 2 weeks at Lake George. That was the big event.
And when you water ski and shit?
Water ski, you go snorkeling, you go fishing.
That's good.
Great.
Good family stuff.
Yeah. Mom's trying to make ziti on a barbecue with a tin foil. Yes.
That's sweet, man. We went skiing.
Yeah?
Yeah, but it was not the same. Like, I always, like, boat people, I'm so, have so much anxiety. Like, I know, like, I think Louis bought a boat. Mm-hmm. Another guy I know, John Groff, bought a boat. I'm like, where the fuck did you put it? When he, what did you?
Well, we didn't live by the water. We trailered it. It sat in the sun. We dug out on our side lawn. We just trimmed the whole place to put the boat in. My father would back the damn thing right into
and
the woods.
And just sit there, you cover it and you sit.
Cover it up, sit there, and we'd wash it every night and take care of it.
That's the boat. And then 2 weeks a year, you took the boat out.
But, well, we'd go in the on Long Island, too. We would go down to and go out into the Long Island Sound.
Did you fish?
North Shore. Yeah, my father wasn't a really big fish guy. He wasn't a fisherman. He liked the boat. He liked the ski. He liked the drive the boat, but he doesn't really like
that. So he knew how to recreate?
Yeah.
All right, so you start doing comedy, and your father says what?
Best thing he ever said, like I said before, I don't have that if-then-go-to statement mechanically. Yeah. Like, my father can fix anything.
Yeah.
Cars, too, is his big thing. It's one of the reasons I like cars is it brings me comfort, but I can't fix them. I know what shit is, but I can't do it.
Yeah.
So I remember, it was Anthony, too. Me and Anthony were trying to do something, brakes on the car, and Anthony leaves.
You're trying to fix the car?
Fix my car, yeah.
And Anthony couldn't do it either?
Well, he did it, but he left and I had something else to
do. He knows how to fix cars?
Yeah, he's really mechanical, Ant. So Ant goes home and I'm trying to do something. And there's, Mark, there's freaking blood and oil and skin and wrenches flying. My father's standing in the doorway. He's got a Lucky Strike hanging out of his mouth.
That was his cigarette?
Yeah, he smoked Luckies. And he was sitting there and I'm just frustrated. And he comes over, he puts his hand on my shoulder and goes, son, you're going to have to get a job. You're going to have to work at something for the rest of your life. This ain't it.
Let it go.
He just saw that you.
He said, this ain't it.
You're not a natural.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I go to college. I come back. And
what did you study there?
Finance. I went to Marist College in Poughkeepsie. And I think I have a degree in finance.
You
and
think?
I think. It's like I went through the motions.
4 years?
4 years, yeah. I got the degree.
But wait, so you weren't doing comedy till after college?
No, I was last year. I was in the band. Like, I was talking about guitar. I was in this terrible band.
In college, the eight-song band, yeah, too.
Eight-song band.
Yeah, Born to be Wild twice. Yeah,
that
yeah.
was it.
Yeah.
And now we...
But was that a real dream of yours? Did you really think that?
No, but being on stage, it felt better than anything else I was doing. I was working at a fence company. I was digging holes and putting up sheds and clearing stuff.
In Poughkeepsie?
In Long Island, but I would drive up to Poughkeepsie.
For school. What was that, like an hour?
Yeah,
hour
and two and a half from Long Island.
So you weren't living up there, you'd have to go?
No, I was in the dorm, but I came home and worked every weekend. Because, you know, first year of college, it was like, everyone drinks too much.
Yeah.
You have friends you think you're going to have forever. I'm in a band, this is it, I'm home.
Yeah.
Then you sober up, year two, you carry an extra 15 pounds, you realize, that guy's a drug addict, he just wrecked my car, no, he owes me money, let me get the fuck out of here.
You realize that.
Yeah.
And you're going to go put fence posts in the ground.
Yeah, so I went to work because I had money in my pocket.
Yeah.
You know. So I worked every weekend because I always had to work. I always needed to.
Well, your dad wasn't going to give you any handouts.
Yeah, it wasn't a lot. There wasn't a stipend.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So I came home and I worked, and I finished college. And I told my father I want to try and be a stand-up. And he took a long drag off the Lucky, and he just went.
Fucking Luckies. I love that he smoked Luckies. It's crazy. Like,
are you going to do this? He goes, do it now. He goes, do it now before your life gets complicated. He goes, the worst feeling in the world you're going to have is you're going to wake up one morning, look in the mirror. There's going to be an old guy looking back at you. And you never want to think, if I only tried a little bit harder.
Yeah.
So give it everything you got.
Fuck.
I was like, fuck, is that great?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember the first time.
Because it wasn't important what it was. It was your commitment and the
do
the,
it.
Yeah, the idea that you're going to have regrets.
That's what I think. And I've come to find this out. He loved his family and he committed to do what he's doing, but he had a lot of regrets. Not that his life turned out the way it was,
right.
But he wanted to be an inventor. He wanted cars. He ran a gas station at 19. He had 40-year-old guys working for him fixing cars and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think my wife actually got to know him when he was dying of cancer, the last 3 years of his life. He got to meet my wife, and he told my wife stuff I never knew about regret.
It's interesting what they talk to women about, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Us, forget it. Where was I when I needed it?
Yeah. He told you that?
Yeah. I didn't know that. You're kidding.
So that's funny. How long have you been married?
I've been married 2 years. We've been together about 8, maybe.
Uh-huh.
So all in, is it 8 or 10? Something like that.
All right, so you start doing comedy the last year of college?
Yeah, last year of college, I started doing comedy.
What was the idea there? You know, because like, you know, you seem to have leveled off a bit with, you know, finding your groove with the Leary camp and doing the acting, and then that kind of got you on to Nurse Jackie and stuff like that. And you're always sort of acting. It was always sort of the thing. But I mean, you were a real comic and you did your time and you fucking had a good headlining set. What was the initial impetus for doing comedy?
Yeah. The initial impetus was prior. It was the comedy albums. We were talking before about the podcast and how we listen to it. And it brings me back again to those, to listening to spoken word, to listening to Richard Pryor, listening to the 2,000-year-old man, Robert Klein.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so Klein was a guy.
Chris Rush. It was more Pryor.
Chris Rush. There's
Remember
an outside,
Rush?
Yeah.
Fucking great.
He's still around, isn't
he? Yeah, he lives in Queens.
Yeah, I feel like I didn't know him that well, but you knew him from live work?
Yeah, I knew him from live and listening to the albums.
Yeah.
And actually being able to talk to him and seek him out.
Yeah, he was around. He had a shaved head for a while, right?
Yeah, still does.
Yeah.
That doesn't come back.
You listen to his records?
Yeah, I had those records.
Really?
Yeah.
How'd you get those records?
I forget. You know where I got them? I got them, I'm going to say, through Anthony had them. We were listening.
That makes sense. When he was starting out on radio?
Yeah. Anthony, Anthony had them.
When you were a kid?
When we were kids. Really? That was one of the guys we would listen
to. Because he was a local guy.
He wasn't, but he was smart as hell.
He did all the smart stuff.
All the sci-fi stuff and all the drug stuff. And
that's interesting. You cite him as an influence because he's like this weird unsung hero.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I should seek him out. I like guys like that. You know, I interviewed Vitaly. I put that.
How's that?
It was great. Yeah. You know, I mean, because it was an almost story.
It's an almost, yeah.
It's a great story about something that almost happened.
Like Anvil.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of like that.
Yeah.
But Danny was always like, you know, like a sweet, tormented guy that just couldn't, you know, get Yeah. You know, he's always going to fuck himself.
Now, who was you? What was the voice that spoke to you that made you to go, okay, I'm going to do this?
Well, when I was a kid, I mean, I loved the old guys like Buddy Hackett and, you know, Don Rickles, Jackie Vernon when I was real young.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that once I saw that first Pryor movie, live in concert.
The Santa Monica concert when Patti LaBelle opened it.
Yeah.
He just walked up
that
with
same
the red
shirt.
Same one.
Once I went
the
to
heart attack bit.
Yeah. Once I went to it was a movie theater and I was like maybe 15.
Yeah.
And me and my buddy Dave, you know, we got our driver's license at 15 in Albuquerque. We went to see a midnight movie of that movie, and that changed everything.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, you're sitting in a fucking movie theater and people are just losing it.
Boom.
Losing it.
I've
never seen anything like that.
No, I had the same experience, but not in a theater, but at the same show. We went to one of those houses. My father was building a kitchen for the rich people.
Yeah.
So, and he's in that, come over the house.
Yeah.
So we would go, and we get, there's one of those places where you get the warning from your mother in the car.
Oh, yeah.
Now, your father does business with these people. Do not embarrass us.
Yeah, don't break anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
You little animals.
So they invite you over. Right?
They're watching Pryor, that concert. And all the adults are in one room, and the kids are playing whatever. The adults go for coffee.
Yeah.
I snuck in.
Yeah.
Rewound the tape, push play. Blew my head off. Yeah. I didn't understand a lot of it, but I remember audibly saying, look what this man can do.
Unbelievable.
And it was
and so light, like so light on his feet and so casual about
and the,
it.
And the pathos, just the feeling.
The emotions.
His heart.
Yeah. He's real, a lot of heart.
And that's what, I think that's why I wanted to be, and again, I'm forming these ideas now looking back, but a professional comic that could perform and move people.
Also make these weird, these like very sort of poignant points about, you know, relationship, about struggle.
Just humanity.
Humanity,
just to give voice to that feeling, because I never, my father, and again, going back to my father, he never really got to address those feelings and give himself any release as far as dealing with emotions. It was just survival.
Yeah, survival and almost like a tradition of how things are done.
Yeah, honorable character.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, like this is what I'm doing. This is what I was trained to do.
Which can lead to a lot of closed-mindedness.
No, absolutely.
You know, I mean, there was a lot of
stubbornness
and
we don't have time to indulge that kind of bullshit.
Yeah.
But that's what's surprising is that he was, you know, so immediately sort of supportive of something that you really wanted to do without dragging you into that, without you dragging into that mindset.
Yeah, well,
you,
I think
beating
he
it out of
I
you.
I couldn't survive in his world. I couldn't thrive in his world.
What about what your brothers end up doing?
Chefs. They're both chefs.
So that's that world, kind of.
Kind of, yeah. Well, it's a very, I mean, even the work ethic.
Chefs
when
work
right.
hard.
Oh, late nights. Well, that was the thing about our house. It was the place, but everything happened late at night because my brothers, they were off work at like, midnight. I'm coming home from a gig.
Uh-huh.
We're making grilled cheese at 1 a.m.
Yeah.
You know?
Chefs, though, man. I love chefs because it's funny because not unlike comedy, there's something immediately satisfying about preparing food.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, you get all your chops in place and then when you fucking, like, you plate that thing, boom, it's like a good joke.
Yeah.
Boom, again.
Instant
boom,
gratification.
Again. It is a little bit. But
bam! Airline bit.
Yeah, exactly. took a year to put it together.
Yeah.
And now I got it up and running.
Yeah. But even when I'm writing, I hear my father's voice, small shit.
Yeah.
It makes that words not right.
It's really?
My sensitivities to why something... Like, as we do this, my editing process has gotten a lot quicker.
It's weird because I build everything on stage, so it takes longer.
I build it too, but do you listen?
Sometimes. I have
been. That's what, and again, I get that from listening to the albums and stuff and with kids. I can listen. I process better by listening.
Well, it's weird that when you nail something that first time and you still can't figure out how to get it back and you can't explain it other than like it just must have been that night.
Yeah.
It was something about the inflection. You know, it's not even the word.
Mm-hmm.
There was just something about the immediacy of that moment that I can't fucking recapture.
And the worst, when you have it and it goes away. You have jokes go away?
Yeah, well, that's just because you're done with it.
Yeah, also, it's also the delivery.
You're not selling it.
Yeah.
You're tired of it.
But even when you exhausted those places to look when something goes away, there was a buddy of mine said there was a play.
Yeah.
And I forget the story, but the play is the guy would get a laugh every time he asked for the tea.
Uh-huh.
And so in the play, he started asking for the tea and the laugh went away. And the director said, you're not asking for the tea anymore. You're asking for the laugh.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I try to say, am I asking for the tea or am I asking for the laugh?
Are you in it or you?
So I always remember that story. And
well, that's sort of the difference between, you know, being in it and doing the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's party after, even when you're tired of bits, it's like, my job is to entertain these people.
Rarely are you in it on a late show Friday.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh God! All right, so okay, so you get in it for Pryor, and you want to do the thing.
Get in it for Pryor. Listen to a lot of, you know, Carlin. Yeah. Listen to all that stuff.
But you like Robert Klein too. That makes
Klein
sense.
And those.
I'm not a big Klein guy.
Not a big Klein guy.
Well, no, and even Carlin, I appreciated him, but he was so anal about you know, like I could never, like I always gravitated towards the guys who are a little more raw. And seemed to be kind of winging
what
it.
What I got from Carlin was the structure. He was very structured.
Yeah. Completely.
I got that from structure. And then the San Francisco guys really got me. Robin and Proops.
Yeah, how'd you come in touch with...
Being a fan.
How'd you find Pearl and Proops
Other comics. Through other comics.
But you must have been touring by that point because no
one... I was out and on the road and, you know, you'd see guys. It's like we...
So early 90s.
Early 90s
on
the road.
You heard about Pearl and Proops.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the first time you see Pearl, you're like, holy fuck.
It's just reference after reference after reference.
And just this weird, maniacal pace. Did you spend time with him off stage?
I've never met him.
Because you can't find his material on anything.
No, there was no YouTube then. There was other guys, you know,
and
telling
there's
you about
definitely that whole... That San Francisco thing that started with Pearl and then Warren Thomas and then Proops and Robin, that core group of that style is very specific.
And then Boston got me, too.
But that's a whole other thing. Gavin and Sweeney.
Rogerson. And I got to work with Rogerson. Those Boston guys, that
whole
was survival.
Thing.
That
whole
was, again,
thing.
That was, again, it was Lenny. Lenny Clark fills up a fucking room. He's just even working with him.
That's where I started working, was in that environment. Knicks, you know, the Catch a Rising Star in Cambridge. But there was these two worlds there that when Catch a Rising Star came in, you had Knicks in all the satellite rooms. But that's where I started working as a comic, was in New England.
Right.
So I would work with all the McDonald's, the, you know, Mike McDonald, George McDonald, Warren McDonald, the Mike is not related to right. George, you know, the Gavins, Don Gavin, and then, you know, Sweeney, sometimes Kevin Knox, before he passed, you know, like, I was definitely, you know, that's where my brain was filled up with how live comedy is done with those Boston guys. But the outside of survival, you know, with the San Francisco and Boston style, regional style, you know, those guys, you know, they had a tone, they had a pace.
There's a Texas style too.
Oh, sure there is, yeah. But like that Boston style, like between Gavin and Lenny, that is some fast shit.
Fast, quick, smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because I on Long Island, it was about the perform. I started with Richie Minervini was the godfather. He was the guy that owned Eastside Comedy. Uh-huh. He gave us all stage time. So it was me, Kevin James, Gary Valentine, Rock Rubin, Matt Burke in Queens, and then Rob Bartlett had an improv group I was in.
Bartlett, I used to hear about. What happened to that guy?
He's still working for IMUS, MSNBC.
Didn't he tour with the women?
His plays and stuff.
Didn't he tour with, like, wasn't there?
He had the Bartletts. He had backup singers and stuff. Right, it was great. It was like all this. It was a whole show.
Yeah.
So we started like that. So I didn't go into the city because I knew that it was a different animal.
How did
than
you
us.
Not end up in the Kevin James camp ultimately?
As far as what?
Well, I mean, it looks like he carried a bunch of people.
Yeah, I've done like three of those episodes, and I was a mall cop with him. The phone rings.
He's a guilty pleasure of mine. It's very funny, you know, because people don't know.
I've seen him work live. I've seen him own a fucking room.
But he's got a natural gift of physical comedy. Like, he's one of those guys where, like, if he's standing still,
yeah,
he can get laughs.
He's got that. Gleason-esque Gigot.
He can't help but be funny. That's this weird, almost genetic.
Yeah, it
gift.
Comes out of him.
Even
the bit. I remember working on the greeting card bit of him just looking for it.
Yeah,
because we started together. What happened was, we had the same agent, and none of us could fill time for a college gig, so we couldn't go on our own.
Right.
So I would do whatever stand-up I had, he would do whatever stand-up he had, and then we'd do the improv games.
Right.
We'd do two-man freeze tag. And
remember when that was
a
thing on the road where you tour, and they're like, you have to do improv games with the headliner and the opener, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, I'm like, I need this. But I grew up doing that in Long Island, so me and Kevin figured out we could make some money doing this.
Right.
And this is how important comedy was to us. We heard the wide right, the Buffalo Bills, New York Giants Super Bowl on the side of the throughway going to do a nooner at Jefferson College.
Oh, those are the worst.
Listening
things.
On the fucking
Why
radio.
Eating lunch?
Oh, terrible. But
the worst.
Comedy was more important to us than football at that point.
That doesn't immediately resonate with me, but I'm sure some people would be like, no.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't have football in my life.
Books?
Sure, whatever.
Sadness?
Yeah. Comedy was more important than
tea
anything.
Tea and tears?
Sure, whatever it was. I definitely did all those gigs, and he never thought twice about it.
No, you took
but
them
you
all.
But you hated going.
Oh.
You knew you were walking into shit.
Yeah.
No winning.
Can we turn off the Pop Shot basketball game before I get up there? I played a bowling alley once.
I did too. Cranston, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Cranston Bowl. I think I've done two bowling alleys. I think there was one in Maine that you used to like, but I remember the Cranston Bowl.
Yeah,
because like back in the day, you had those, you know, the one-nighters. Mm-hmm. You had the colleges,
yep.
And we weren't big college acts, so you'd mm-mm. get the crap colleges, or you'd be a lower budget. That, you know, if Anthony Clark couldn't make it, you know. It was not, the money was too low for Anthony. Yeah. He didn't want to do the lunch gig.
Yeah.
Yeah, if Ed Regine, like Barry Katz had all of that shit, all that NACA shit wrapped up, but there was all those one-nighters, so you mm-hmm. never knew what the fuck.
Colleges
are the worst because you get these student activities people that tell the booker, like, yeah, we'll set up the room. You walk in, like, you chairs? Can we have chairs?
Yeah.
Oh, you need chairs? Yeah, microphone be good.
Yeah.
You know, too.
Is there a light to stand under?
Ridiculous.
I remember when I first started, the best gigs you got was the ones that actually said comedy club after the...
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You're working...
Not comedy night.
Yeah, you're working the Steak and Sword. Yeah. You know, you're working this restaurant.
Comedy night. Yeah.
Not comedy night, but comedy club. I'm like, oh, this is the real deal now.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah.
My whole first 2 years of doing stand-up was one-nighters.
It was all bars and struck to get people's
hotel
attention.
Hotel ballrooms.
Oh, those four gigs. Four-wall joints.
Yeah. Like, they would just contract out to anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes, your one gig would be the last of it.
Yeah.
You never knew if the gigs will last.
Madame Wu's Comedy Den in Weehawken.
Mikey
was a Chinese restaurant.
Well, Mike Clark had a few of those,
mm-hmm.
you know, but like his have lasted. I mean, Giggles at the
still there.
Tower of Pizza, that lasted. And he had to, he booked me on one of the first fucking gigs I ever did. Mike Clark did. I still know his phone number. It's weird.
I wish they could see your face.
Like, out of all the people in the world, like, you know, when you're starting out and you're calling the bookers, like, you know, I still know his.
Yeah.
And it's still his fucking number. It's bizarre, because it wasn't even like I worked for him that much, but he, you know, I was one of the kind of guys like me that mm-hmm. he would use. I was able to cross over somehow, and they would use
that was
me.
It. There was some guys that could do the gig and some guys that couldn't do the gig. That was the difference between Long Island comics was more of a, it was a show. It was a presentation mm-hmm. where the city comics was more like, you know, thinking and stand-up. It was observational comedy.
Right. Well, you had to fight it out. You were going into an adverse situation.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't going into a comedy club. You weren't protected by the idea that, like, you know, this is a club. This is where people come.
There's an unspoken contract of their behavior.
Right. When you go out and do nothing, it's like you're fighting for your life.
Yeah.
And that's where you learn how to fight for your life. It's like, these people and I couldn't have less in common. Mm-hmm. That was always my struggle.
Right.
Like, if I went to Long Island or any of these Boston gigs, it's like, I'm walking into not enemy territory, mm-hmm. but I'm certainly nothing that they would expect. Yeah. So how am I going to bend that into something that they fucking get?
They can trust to.
Yeah. How am I going to do that?
Especially, but, and then when they're drinking, I used to call it Lion Tamer comedy with the whip in the chair.
Oh my God, dude. Oh, but the Derby Park in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
That was when
Lowell.
Yeah. Opening for Chris Shino. That was one of my first paid gigs. Mike Clark sent me out there, and it was a long standing gig in Lowell. And it was like you were up on this thing. I don't remember it being necessarily, it wasn't a large stage, but I remember there was sort of a brass, you know, thing around it, and people right here and right here, and oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember driving up there with Crescino, and he was already bitter, so that my first experience was with the guy,
That's the reason I worked quite a bit, because I had a car.
Yeah.
Oh, so yeah. I would do like all those Connecticut, John Shula gigs and Gary Grant. If you pick up the headliner in New York,
sure, that's
you
right.
could do it.
That's right.
And Patty Rossborough was a big college act, and we had the same agent. So I would drive Patty, because Patty, like, I was Patty Rossborough approved.
Yeah.
So I would drive, and I would take the hits and yell at everybody and settle them down. And go, pay attention to this fucking lady.
Yeah. Be nice.
And kill.
Be nice.
So, yeah.
So then you became, like, a touring headliner pretty quick, though.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to do that, and then I got a deal when they were giving everyone's deals. So I moved out to California.
You did?
Yeah.
Like,
93.
Oh, yeah? Early on. So you're a kid still, really.
Yeah. And again, not knowing anything and just coming out.
What was the deal for you? You pitched a show? You got what?
No.
Where'd you get
seen? Someone found me on MTV. Because we were all, remember, everyone could do TV then. If you had 5-6 minutes, you could do TV.
Basic Cable had a million stand-up shows.
Yeah. And it was I remember the first one I think I did was Evening at the Improv or A&E
sure.
or something.
Yeah, A&E, Evening at the Improv,
Rosie
Carol,
had one.
And, Caroline's Comedy Hour, Stand Up Spotlight.
Something like that.
And then MTV did the Half Hour Comedy Hour, but that was, mm-hmm. That was HBO. MTV did the...
No, Half Hour Comedy Hour was MTV's Half Hour Comedy
Right, I remember those. And then there was the A-List, Comedy Central had a few shows before they did the Premium Blends, mm-hmm. a different version of it. Comedy on the Road was another one.
Oh, John Biner.
I never did that one. That was like the one I
didn't
do.
I never did that one either, but John Biner was on The Odd Couple, and I always wanted to do it.
Yeah, Biner was the character.
What do you have under leaky pipes? Puddles?
Yeah. So you come out to L.A. and you get
come out
fucking
to LA
handed
and
your ass?
Yeah, I come out and then, we're going to pair you with a writer. Why don't you help me write? Yeah, well, you can't write. Times, all that bullshit.
That's the weirdest thing, dude. And it still works that way. Where you're going
to, it was odd because they were trying to write this show for me, but I was having more fun on other people's shows. I was on Flying Blind. I played a nerd on that show, and I was on did a couple episodes of Caroline in the City. So I was working...
While you were out here.
An actor and then going on the road to make stand-up
to do
stand-up and then coming back and have this deal just fall apart that would roll into another deal that would fall apart
but you had a good run of them.
Yeah, we made them. I mean, everyone
I never made one.
We made them all, but then they were all... And I got to meet these people. I got... Alex Rocco played my father.
Oh, yeah.
Lainey Kazan played my mother in one
wild? I just had that experience for the first time with my show, recently. I finally got the opportunity to make something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, Sally Kellerman and Judd Hirsch are my parents.
Great!
It's kind of wild.
Fucking great!
It's wild.
When you get to meet these people, I walked in and met Alex Rocco.
Mo Green.
Well, that's what it was. I met him at the Sportsman Lodge. Yeah. He came down to read. He was going to read with me for the network. Uh-huh. And I had to say, pay my respect. I open up the door and I just looked at him and I said, Frankie, draw a trip so everyone can play in the house. And then he comes right in, right in with the words. He goes, you know who I am? I'm Mo Green. He did the words right there for me with a big fucking smile on his face. Yeah. I loved him from that. He was so gracious.
It's amazing.
So the show doesn't get picked up. Yeah. Right? It's terrible. He calls me up, and I'm depressed 2 days, just wandering around.
Yeah.
Phone rings. Hello. Kid, it's Rocco.
Yeah.
I put my retirement in your hands, and you fucked it up. He goes, don't let those bastards be in control of your happiness, and hung up the phone.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sweet.
And I've never heard from him since, but I had that moment.
He seemed to have a lot of great moments with old Italian guys. Your father.
Old Gindaloons,
The
old Gindaloons.
So what broke you? Why'd you go back?
I got the job. I got the show with Leary. I auditioned for it here, and they shot in New York.
You've been living here ever since, one way or another?
Yeah, I've been back and forth since '93.
But you had an apartment in New York.
I had an apartment here. I got rid of it. Then I went back to New York.
Because I knew your ex, I knew that thing was a...
Yeah, so we were living in New York.
Yeah.
And then that show we shot. And then I went back out on the road and did a couple of other shows. And then Rescue Me... picked back up, and Dennis picked up the phone. Lenny actually picked up the phone and said, I was talking to Lenny about something, and Dennis had this character, and I went back and did Rescue Me for 4 or 5 years for that.
Yeah,
and then
it's funny.
Top Gear and Nurse Jackie.
Well, it's funny because I work with Serpico's,
I know.
My guy, and it's so funny.
Shaletti and all those guys.
Yeah, but what's really funny is that Serpico and that whole crew, really,
mm-hmm.
If you watch that one episode that Leary's on with the dead possum under the house, where it's funny because it's like me and you as well, is that I'm not the kind of guy that they innately understand. Yeah.
I'm an acquired taste. There's something there.
Yeah, he's like a man, but he seems to have female problems. he's like a man, but he's like a woman in a way because he's complaining about you. But but it was very funny to work with those guys, and Dennis too, because out of all the people that sort of believed in the project, Serpico was he loved the podcast. He's we got to be able to do something with it. And I'm in there, and I'm like, I feel like I'm from a different world than you. but it did work out because I am. The weird thing is that I think it's very hard for different types of men to sort of integrate. There's this idea that there's those kind of guys and there's these kind of guys, and they've been fighting for centuries.
Yeah,
they're the guys that are guys, and then there's these other things.
Uh-huh.
they can't seem to land on it. They're not manning up.
He's got a sweater.
Yeah, something. Yeah. But it was a great experience because oddly, you know, despite all my neurotic, anxious, you know, heady bullshit, mm-hmm. I'm still just a dude. You know, yeah. I got all the same problems.
It's the same bullshit, but yeah. It's also
it's
funny.
You just remove sports.
The nice,
you know, just there's fewer things to bond on. Yeah. But the machinery's the same.
The funny's there. That's the important thing. The funny's there, and that's one of the things I like about, you know, the podcast and listening to guys like, I catch up with my friends who I haven't heard from a while,
right.
But I'm open up to different funny, and I can, and Serpico can find the fucking funny.
Yeah, and he's just so good at his goddamn job. And yeah. But like, it's interesting because like one of my first experiences of really fucking tanking it was, you know, and it was back in those days where, you know, I was trying to work at regular clubs in Boston, being the aggravated Jew guy that I am. And I had a guest spot at Nick's when it was big. And, Leary goes on before me. You know, he's going to go do 20 and I'm going to do a 10 or an 8 or 10. And this is back when Leary, he had a ponytail. He had a braided ponytail. Mm-hmm. That's how far back this is. He was just a, you know, a force of nature. He gets up there and I don't even know if he did well. Didn't matter. Right. Just the pace of it just annihilated the room. And then I made this, I got up there and I'm like, I'll just jump on his wave. Mm-hmm. And I tried, and it was like, it was that kind of silence that has a vacuum to it.
Yeah.
Where you're just up there and it's like, exactly. And it was like the worst 8 minutes, one of the worst 8 minutes of my life. That kind of bombing.
Yeah.
I haven't done it in a while, but that, it's one thing if you don't do, like if you can't get over, you know, it's part of the job and you, you know, you do what you can. It still sucks. Mm-hmm. But the kind of bombing where there's this sort of a,
they're stunned first.
They're stunned.
You know, the doom is coming.
Right. Or you feel like you're imposing somehow. Yeah, like, what's this? Who's this guy?
I'm sorry. Is this a bad time?
Yeah, exactly. Right. I haven't had that in a while.
Oh, those was, and that's the worst feeling, especially when it first happens, because I would get that on the road.
Yeah.
Because you got to realize, we were on the road with kids, had one in Virginia, some fucking club of Virginia.
Yeah.
And what is this? Why does this joke always works? And then,
and when they always work and they don't.
And then you're by yourself and you're done and you have no idea who you are, because who you are is what you just projected on stage and they didn't like it.
Yeah, so like, why did I do what I did? Who am I? Where am I?
Yeah.
I'm going to go walk around the mall.
I got to remember how to get back to my hotel with a 40 ounce.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
At some gas station.
The worst.
Eating
the
truck stopper sandwich, not knowing who I am.
So
welcome.
Yeah. So you like, but you know, the thing with Dennis, you know, he liked your character and he showed up and he fit into that whole crew.
Well, I met Dennis at the audition. I went in to read for the Tommy Minetti character. Yeah, when we get auditions.
And that one, what did that go, 2 seasons?
Yeah, 19 episodes, 2 seasons, ABC. But what we did was, you know, when you go for auditions on tape,
I'm
never going to see these fucking people again. So I did it.
Yeah.
Dennis told me later, he goes, you were the second to last one on a tape and we called you in to read with him. So there was really no bullshit. You go and you read. He sifts through everything, picks out the ones he wants. I read with him. It was me, Dennis, Peter Tolan, and a cameraman.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
I didn't know. It was at the Chelsea Piers in New York. I didn't know. Everyone was up watching, like in the rafters. But Dennis wanted to set the environment of just being too...
You couldn't see them people?
No, I had no idea. The camera was there. I thought they were just taping it. They were feeding it. The Serpico was up and all those guys were up there.
Interesting.
For this. And we just started improvising. And I started making him laugh, and it was that same kind of, I felt the training of the improv from improving within the clubs and laughs, and our timing was similar. And it was that moment really worked well. And then Serpico came out and shook my hand. I'm Jim Serpico, and he was a Long Island guy and kind of knew who I was.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know when you do something and you're still out of your body?
You're
trying to be professional. I think it's a very interesting project. I'd love to be a part of it.
I got
to
get out
before you fuck anything up.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. And I got the call later and just became... we became part of, you know, I was inducted into the family. I always called Dennis the skinny Irish Sinatra. But it was a nice place, and it's baptism by fire, Mark. He goes, make me laugh on this take. You know, Dennis would just yell.
Yeah.
You know? And I was partners with Lenny.
Yeah.
That's like being the guy on the tank just feeding the ammunition into the cannon.
Lenny's something else.
You know,
he always scared me. He still scares me.
But he's the sweetest guy, and he's just a force of nature. We found a way to work
together.
But
I knew him back in, like, you know, I knew him when I was a kid and, you know, doorman at the Comedy Store, and everyone was fucked up. And, you know, and I knew him from Boston a little bit, and he was like the king of Boston, very intimidating. And, like, I was always scared of him. And I think I still am. I think I'm still a little scared of them. They all scare me because I always felt like, you know, there's this, you know, there was like this Irish tribe unity in Boston where I'm like, you know, I'm never going to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and how, like, and even when I was accepted by them a little bit, I'm like, this can't be trusted.
Right. Yeah. As soon as shit goes wrong, I'm the first one to throw off.
Oh, yeah. I'm done.
But when you're in that, when they make you, I would tell you when my dad died.
When was that? When did that? What show were you doing then?
I was doing. What was I doing? It was the end of Rescue Me, the beginning of Top Gear. He got diagnosed with cancer. I remember I was on a movie set. I was working, and he got diagnosed. And fuck. And I went home. And Dennis and Lenny.
How many years ago was that?
He died in 2010. He got diagnosed in 2007, I think.
And So Dennis and Lenny, what?
I was working. We were still doing Rescue Me, They just took the time they didn't really say anything. They just kind of, I remember sitting in the trailer, just quiet, just sitting.
When he already had cancer.
Yeah. And like I just remember the moment of having those guys just be real. It was very quiet. Not a lot of people said anything, but I knew that it was okay. If I wanted just to break down right there, I could have. I didn't.
Right.
But I felt like I had permission from them. And it was all unspoken. And it was a profound feeling. I'm still trying to articulated,
but it was. And they'd been through that kind of loss.
Well, he lost his dad.
Yeah.
Lenny had since lost his mom after that.
Yeah.
And that was another.
It's a weird thing.
Emotional place that we kind of went through together. Lenny showed up at my father's funeral in red pants. Just these giant red, and everyone knows all the Gindaloon, because there was all kinds of, you know, cops, criminals, plumbers. Everyone showed up.
Yeah.
And Lenny walked in, and I heard, I think Lenny Clark's out there. Adam, it's just big Lenny. Yeah. I love you. Came, hugged my mother.
He's a big teddy bear. Yeah. Big scary teddy bear.
Really nice.
Well, the interesting thing about it seems that both of my folks are still around. It's not something I've had to process immediately, you know, in my own experience. But, you know, when there's a diagnosis and there's a long term illness, that the grief, you know, is sort of cushioned by the fact that you have time to connect.
Yeah. It's a different kind of pain, because I've also had a friend of mine also who had someone taken suddenly from him.
Yeah.
So now there's that whole process you got to process of.
Right, but I think it's different. I think that knowing that you're dealing with a terminal situation, and if you have loose ends, at least you can.
Hey, yeah, you have the ability to do that, but then it's also. This the denial phase. There was a lot of, we're going to beat this thing, and my father, we're going to beat this thing.
What kind of cancer?
He had bladder cancer.
Jesus.
And they didn't catch it till late, and it was cigarettes and everything. And I remember me and him, we were in the garage, and it was one of those moments he just looked at me and he goes, I ain't going to win.
Yeah.
But I ain't going to fucking give up either. Don't tell your mother. He goes, he actually says, he goes, I ain't going to make it easy on the motherfucker. I said, okay. Whatever you want to do.
Oh my God. So that was the end of the denial.
Yeah, that moment was the end of the denial. And it was, and then, you know, it didn't last as, it lasted longer than I thought it would.
How long?
The denial?
You
get 3 years. I think, someone always said, you're going to get 3 years no matter what you do. I mean, he did the chemo, but it was 3 years.
And
it was a lot. And the helplessness you feel like, you know, because you can't do anything, you know.
But they make him comfortable, right?
He was old school.
Oh, really? They want their drugs?
Yeah, after a while. Yeah. Not real, I'll take them. But give me two.
Was there stuff that, you know, you said that your wife got some stuff from him?
Yeah, my wife, and I remember the day I took him out to lunch, and I would always go out there. I would always, whenever New York, and I would always just go out and watch football with him, just sit there with him, just to be with him.
Uh-huh.
Be my mom, I had to be there.
Yeah.
And love my wife, love my wife. And he would tell her stories, and we haven't seen you in a while. I'd tell my father, come into the city. I'm not coming to the city. I got to drive, I got traffic, tolls, there's no place to park. And my wife would go, you know, we haven't seen you. Why don't you come? How about Thursday?
Yeah,
I can come in on Thursday.
Uh-huh.
And he would come in and spend time. And
and
he loved her, and he would tell her all this stuff. That's how I found out about there might have been some regret that he didn't get to fulfill the artistic whatever he was doing. Like, because he got to design kitchens and bathrooms, and he took what his father gave him to another level.
Right.
I went to a totally different place with his blessing.
But he was also able to see some of your amazing success.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that was that. The Rescue Me tour. This was a great moment we did. Because, you know, fucking Leary's always. We're doing a Rescue Me tour. So the warm-up gig is Mohegan Sun.
Uh-huh.
7,000 people in the arena. That's the fucking warm-up gig.
In Connecticut?
For the tour, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're
in the big room.
In the big room.
Yeah.
So, and after that, we had Radio City. So I said, Pop, I'm playing Radio City. He goes, I heard. Listen, your mother said you're playing the Mohegan Sun. Can we come to that gig? So yeah. He could fucking gamble. That's right. Why he wanted to come.
Yeah.
So I said, you're going to come to the show? He goes, of course I'm going to come to the show. You know, unless I get on a rush or something, yeah. But I should be there. He goes, you're going to do the Jews? Because yeah. I had this bit about yeah. Moses. Questioning faith and people uh-huh. following Moses to yeah. the desert and some guy in the back yelling, hey, I don't think he knows where he's going.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's this piece about questioning Moses.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, Pop, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So I do the gig. And he has big mane of white hair.
Yeah.
And I did the gig and I got a big applause break. And as the applause break is going, I look down, I see my father. I said, okay, Pop, you happy? I did it.
Yeah.
And I said to everyone, I go, that's my father. He was yeah. gambling. He said, I'll come to the show if you do the Moses bit.
Yeah.
And then everyone was clapping.
Yeah.
So comes times next year, we're doing the tour again.
Yeah.
And he can't make it. He's just too ill. So I said, Pop, come on. I'll send a coffee. You come. We're doing yeah. a gig again. Yeah, Mohegan Sun. And he went, ah. He goes, that was one of the greatest things I ever saw. I go, why? He goes, you were on stage. You're making everybody laugh. You with your friends. And you, everyone in that audience, when you said my name, everyone in that audience was looking at me. And I was looking at you. And my heart just fucking fell out. I just, now? Yeah. Now?
Now?
Now I get, you're dying, and I have this love now.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But he said it would just yeah. water his eyes, and yeah, I could yeah. see how happy he was. So I had that moment.
Oh, that's fucking beautiful.
You know? Yeah. You get that shit.
Yeah.
And that's the shit I hold on to.
Yeah, and you have closure around it, and you feel like yeah. it's all, you know.
I have closure because it's not that I have closure, it's I felt like I didn't want him in here anymore.
Yeah.
And at some level, I think he decided to take the hit.
Yeah.
So it would be easier for us to adjust when
he's gone.
It's
time to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
he went out the way he would want. He went out in his chair with his family. We were hugging him. It was like the top shot, the crane shot.
You
in the
knew
movie.
It was happening?
Yeah.
Oh, because it was like the doc said, like
Hospital
this. Is
was
it.
At my house, and my mother's cousin is a nurse.
Yeah.
And she said, it's close.
Yeah.
So we were all there. His kids were holding. I was holding them.
Yeah.
I was holding them as the life left them.
Really?
Kissed them on the forehead. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's
we were all there.
At home.
At home, in his chair, which I still have.
Yeah, you do?
Yeah, I still got the chair.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that's a touching story because I think that's the way it's supposed to happen.
Well, yeah,
I mean, in the sense that, like, not in the hospital.
Yeah, really. It's like, but you look at what could have been,
yeah.
and then I still got the fucking anger of why, you know, what did he do? And there is no, it's cause and effect.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
can't
yeah.
smoke Lucky Strikes for 30 years and think nothing's going to happen.
Right, yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, how old was he?
69,
so young in terms.
Yeah,
in the
yeah. in this world, 69 years old.
So you don't have kids?
No,
not yet.
No,
or is that it? Kids. No, no,
yeah. not. I don't. Me and my wife, we might adopt. Me and my wife keep talking. We keep talking about it, yeah. and then we're like, yeah, let's lay down.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Well, yeah, you get to a certain age where you wonder. Your brothers have kids?
My brother's got two kids. I got two god kids.
Yeah,
which are great because I send them all the stuff from.
You get to be the good uncle.
Oh yeah, I get to come in and give them stuff they're not supposed to have, and uh-huh. send them videos. We just did an episode of Top Gear where we made. I made a Pope mobile out of a 69 Lincoln.
Oh, really?
And I got to drive Cloris Leachman to the Emmys, so I get to do all this weird stuff. We made our own snowmobile.
Oh, that's
made
fun.
Our own snowplow.
Wait, so you work with mechanics and they're good?
Yeah, I draw the stuff up, and we all have, well, what if we build on the build shows we have?
Isn't that funny, though, because you're sort of honoring the idea that, you know, your father didn't think you could...
I don't build. I can't build them.
No, I know, but nonetheless, you're involved with that.
Yeah, well, that's the greatest thing, because I love cars bring great comfort to me because of my father. In fact, I just bought... a 1970 Buick Deuce and a Quarter. It's an electric 225. Uh-huh. My grandfather had this car. I just bought it because the sound of that motor and that big armrest and that big car reminds me of my dad.
Yeah.
And that brings me... Football, cars bring me comfort. The Odd Couple.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Those Columbo. Yeah.
It's just so funny that your career sort of has got you involved in that thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing cars.
Yeah. But, and he would love to have seen it. So I'm restoring this car.
Yeah.
So I can drive around in this big car and think of my dad.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, good, man. It was great talking to you. Well,
good to catch up with you, my friend.
Yeah, buddy. That was a great talk. Sweet guy. We're both hanging in there. I'm glad things are going well for Adam. Go to WTFpod.com. If you're new to the podcast, go get the app, the free app, upgrade, stream all 500 and however many we're at now. Enjoy. Comment sections are limited to Facebook now because I don't like the anonymity of douchebags. Douchebags don't deserve protection. So now if you're going to comment, I can see you. I can see you. Feels good. All right. Oh, I got a pain in my shoulder. Which shoulder is the bad one? Boomer lives!